sure you are in fellowship, if necessary, and continue on here and wrap this up and get on to the next verses. We are down to about point 57, dealing with idolatry, the idol worshiper. That is one of the categories, idolaters, that will find their part in the lake of fire. 57, the concept of idolatry is simply that of exalting anything beyond its proper sphere and giving it the place in life that God reserves for himself. Exodus 24, where God spells out the fact that he does not care for this activity, and that people are to avoid it at all costs. And, of course, this is a part of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Here we have the concept of righteousness expressing itself in what people mostly consider to be a negative emotion, but here is a positive aspect of that. As we pointed out, all the sins that you can commit, anger, pride, jealousy, these types of things, have a positive expression. They aren't always sinful. There is righteous anger. There is legitimate boasting. Boasting normally among people is a sin, and it's an STA activity that they engage in, and that's forbidden. But God says, if anyone boasts, let him boast in the fact that he knows me. So there's legitimate boasting, as we saw in like the letters of Paul. He refers to it. There's legitimate jealousy. And so you have here this desire for complete devotion that God expresses. And basically, an idol is, again, taking something that's reserved for God alone and giving it to something else. Deuteronomy 27:15. Also deals with this concept. Cursed is the man who makes an idol or a molten image, an abomination to the Lord, the work of the hands of the craftsman, and sets it up in secret. And all the people shall answer and say, Amen. Isaiah 45:20 deals also with this idea of the stupidity of idol worship. Based on the fact that why would you worship some inanimate object? I mean, there is the living God, and then there are all these things that are so much less than that. And again, we don't do it the way they tended to do it. We worship things like technology, celebrity, fame, these types of things. We tend to, our idols tend to be invisible, but they're idols nonetheless. And all the things God says about visible idols, guess what? He feels the same way about invisible idols. And so just because people can't see them, gather yourselves and come. Draw near together, you fugitives of the nations. They have no knowledge, who carry about their wooden idol and pray to a God who cannot save. And he talks about the stupidity of people as they will go out and cut down a piece of wood out of the forest. And part of it they burn with fire, and the other part of it they make an idol out of. Well, how do you know which part was supposed to be the idol? And so it's ineffective, and obviously can't really do anything for you. All the technology that man worships is not going to save him. All the things that they can think, say, and do, and all of that, computers aren't going to be the answer to our problems. Technology in any form is not the answer to our problems, and in many cases, all technology has done is complicated our lives and made it more complicated rather than less. I thought sort of the idea behind it was to make man's life easier, but in some cases, it just serves to make it more difficult. And you can also see Hosea 4:12 and Habakkuk 2:18. 58, those of us living in Babylon in the last days should recognize that the pursuit of money and the details of life is the most prevalent form of idol worship. Colossians 3:5 deals with the greed factor, that it's never enough. No matter what we get, we've always got to have something newer and better. You can't just get a TV, you got to get an HD TV. How well do you need to be able to see the football game? Oh, it's just like being there. No, it's not. I don't care how well they can beam it into your house, Scotty. It's not like being there. First, it costs a lot less than being there. And you don't have the security screenings for being there. And hot dogs aren't $8 at the house. And a beer isn't $5. So, no, it's quite a bit different than being there. But if I get me a plasma TV, high-definition surround sound, it's going to be like I'm there. Wow, good for you. We'll still see the same show, I'm sure. And, you know, I'm like, where does it end? And it never ends. It's always something people are convinced they've got to have newer, bigger, better. And the software companies make a killing on the fact that Americans are so stupid. Oh, you've got to upgrade, really? Why? Doesn't my program do everything I need it to? Yeah, but this one has more bells and whistles. This one will greet you by name when you sit down at your keyboard. Oh, wow, that's important. I feel very touched, like when I log on to my Comcast and they say, good morning, Ron. I mean, that means a lot to me. I can tell they care. Good grief, people are so stupid. I'm still running Word 97. How can you live? Well, I don't know. If something isn't good and it's an improvement, fine. They just sent out the last deal on their last zone alarm update. Was a freaking nightmare. Anybody that used it had all kinds of problems. Oh, we're making your life easier. Stay away. You know, will garlic keep these people away, or a crucifix or something? No. Colossians 3:5, therefore consider the members of your earthly body as dead to immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which amounts to idolatry. For it is, and this is the verse I was talking about, for it is on account of these things that the wrath of God will come. And these things are what bring the wrath of God on people. As they engage in these sinful activities. We saw it in there in the passage in Revelation 18 about Babylon. Her sins are piled as high as heaven. Well, 59, the final category that is mentioned, is set apart grammatically from the previous groups by use of the adjective pos and the repetition of the definite article. 60, the Bible frequently stigmatizes this sin of lying, which is viewed as being much more serious than people generally tend to think. Psalm 5:9, people will lie. Some people will look you in the eye and lie to you and never bat an eye about it. There are people, I think, who compulsively lie and they don't even know they're lying anymore. It's just as easy to lie as it is to tell the truth. Now, at least one of the things I always tried to do was I always tried to have a good reason for lying. Not that that's any better, but the point is there are people that lie just for the sake of lying, just because it gives them some sort of perverse thrill. And, I usually lied out of self-preservation. You know, I was going to get a spanking if I got found out, so I'd lie about it. And but there are people, again, there are natural-born liars, Psalm 5:9. There is nothing reliable in what they say. Their inward part is destruction itself. Their throat is an open grave, and they flatter with their tongue. Hold them guilty, O Lord, and by their own devices they will fall. Psalm 31:18, we saw it in the Proverbs passage there, that it's on God's hit list of one of the seven things he really hates that are an abomination, was lying. Psalm 31:18, let the lying lips be dumb, which speak arrogantly against the righteous with pride and contempt. And so people that are so quick to pass judgment, you better, one thing, if you're dealing with believers, you better be pretty damn careful. And make sure you got all your ducks in a row in the first place before you pass. And people are quick to do this. Look at a situation, size it up, pass judgment, boom. And that's the way it is. So let God deal with people. God will deal with people. See, this is something people have lost confidence in, because God appears at this point sometimes not to be doing anything. God appears very removed from our experience. While we believe in God and we talk about God and we pray to God, but in large measure sometimes it seems as though God's not doing what we think he ought to be doing. And so people conclude that, well, God's just, you know, he's not ever going to do anything. Well, that's wrong. He is going to do something. And again, we talk about the wheels of God's justice may grind slowly, but they get everything. Nothing escapes it. And so let God deal with people, put them in God's hands, leave them there, and, you know, let him deal with it. Let him handle it. He knows who the liars are, who the truth tellers are, and all that. And you can see all these other verses, Proverbs 6, 17, 10, 18, 12, 19, 22, 21, 6, and Isaiah 59, 13. 61, it is certainly listed as one of the chief characteristics of Satan, who is described by Jesus Christ as being a murderer and a liar. John 8, 44. And so, he originated this sin. It is one of his favorites, no doubt, along with pride. He originated the sin of murder as he spiritually killed Adam and Eve through his lies, and that's the nature by which he commits his murders, is by lies. Verse 44, you're of your father the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father. He was a murderer from the beginning and has not stood in the truth because there is no truth in him. I mean, he's completely bankrupt when it comes to truth. Whenever he speaks the lie, again, it's definite in the Greek. He speaks from his own nature. For he is a liar and the father of lying. And so he originated it, and those that emulate him continue to act in that fashion as a part of their family characteristic. 62, liars encompass a broad spectrum of people, from those that lie about insignificant things, to those that lie for the sake of gaining an advantage. We can see the Jude 16 passage there. To those that lie in a legal setting. And the worst types, religious liars. Jude talks about that. The people engage in certain activity, Jude 16. Talks about these specific categories of unbelievers. They are grumblers, finding fault, following after their lust. They speak arrogantly, flattering people for the sake of gaining an advantage. And some people lie and flatter. You know, they'll tell you how great you are. They're just lying through their teeth. You're not great. But people's egos, they like to hear that kind of thing. Oh, yeah, you're right. I am great. At least we're agreed on that. To those that lie in a legal setting, like 1 Timothy 1:10, any sort of a legal setting, but this type of thing, like perjury, is listed here as being one of the reasons why we have laws, and specifically the Mosaic Law, moral codes. Why? Because certain things are flat wrong, and the law delineates that which is wrong and prohibits it. And so, but the problem is people abuse the Mosaic Law, and they were abusing it during Paul's day as well, not using it as it's meant to be used. But part of this list is knowing the fact, verse 9, that the law is not made for a righteous man, but for those who are lawless and rebellious, for the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy and profane, for those that kill their fathers or mothers, for murderers, for immoral men and homosexuals, and kidnappers and liars and perjurers. And whatever else is contrary to sound teaching. See, a righteous person, you don't have to tell them don't kill people. They won't kill people anyway. You don't have to tell them not to perjure themselves. They tell the truth. A righteous person does that. That characterizes the righteous and all those other things. And he leaves this list open-ended. Again, this is not designed to be exhaustive, but designed to point out that there are moral laws against homosexuality because this is opposed to sound teaching. So there are so many ways you can nail that one. And then religious liars, let's look at the 1 Timothy 4 here. You can also see Ezekiel there, but Zechariah 10:2. But 1 Timothy 4:2, here we have the prophecy with respect to the rise of monasticism and all of that. And how did we get these doctrines, as we saw, that have now permeated the human race in some ways? The filth. The doctrines that are in the cup of the great prostitute, where'd they all come from? Well, they were introduced into the human race through demonic influence, and perpetrated by and furthered by evil men. Believers, too, not just unbelievers. This is the whole point of this. These are people, explicitly the Spirit says, in later times some will walk away from the faith. In other words, they were with it at one time. And that's the worst kind of enemy, the religious liar, because, and especially someone who was at one time straight, because they have a whole lot of things they're going up against. So they really have to sear their conscience to go back. And these people, they get good at it, at searing the conscience to where anything goes, basically. Wrong is right, and right is wrong, and however they see it is the way it is. And they throw out entire sections of the Scripture to justify their own theology and their own viewpoint and their own actions. And so these religious liars, they're not content just to do this. They have to go after whole families, as we saw there in Titus. They're not just content to lie and to malign God and to throw out doctrines. They upset whole families. They become the catalyst for widespread destruction and furthering the stupidity of false doctrine. So here, they walk away, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons by means of the hypocrisy of liars, seared in their own consciences with a branding iron. And we saw a couple of their doctrines, celibacy of the priesthood and abstaining from certain foods. So there's no food, it's unclean. You can eat anything you want. I was watching one of those cooking shows, this guy's eating chocolate-covered grasshoppers. Well, go. I'm not going to eat them. If you like them, fine. You know? If you like liver and onions, eat it to your little heart's content. I don't care. I'm not going to eat it. You know, whatever you like to eat's fine. Eat it. There's nothing unclean out there. There's nothing that's going to bring you down. Spiritually, that is. So, again, there are the worst types are religious liars, and especially the worst types are religious liars who are one time straight, because they have an era, or an aura, rather, of that cause people to trust them, because people did trust them. And those are the dangerous ones. Well, 63, one thing that should be very obvious is the types of activities mentioned here are all designed to advance the one performing them. Very often, unbelievers engage in these types of things for no reason other than their own personal benefit. They're selfish. And that's the way they live their lives. And if you're going to live your life as a selfish person, well, guess what? You're not ever going to be happy. Happiness is not found in serving yourself. Happiness is found in serving others. And so why are people unhappy? That's one of the things I've been reflecting on as I'm starting to think about Ecclesiastes. Why was Solomon so unhappy at the end of his life? He had it all. He had all the money, all the fame, all the women. People think, I'd be happy if I just had more women. I need three wives. God help you. Or 700 wives. Or, you know, and so Solomon had 1,000 women. Was he happy? No. Didn't make him happy. And he had all the money, all the wine he wanted. He could do whatever he wanted. He had unlimited freedom, unlimited time, unlimited funds. He was not at all. So he explored how to make himself happy. And you know what he found out? All of his exploration led him to one conclusion. You can't make yourself happy. So where is happiness to be found? That sort of becomes the question. And Solomon is pretty clear as you're reading that book that Solomon bases all this. I mean, there's a fundamental overriding. People have said, well, Ecclesiastes is written about life as the unbeliever sees it. No, it's not. God is mentioned lots and lots of times in that book. He has an undercurrent of a belief in God, and he believes in a righteous God who will judge every deed. And but his bigger exploration deals with sort of the horizontal rather than the vertical relationship with God, his horizontal relationship out in the world and what he sees and what he observes. And after observing life, and Solomon was old when he wrote this, and he's pretty jaded because he's basically catered to himself for quite a number of years and is either in the process of spiritual recovery or all of that. But what's he say? I had it all. I did it all. I wasn't happy. Selfish people aren't happy people. And you see people and they're unhappy and you think, well, I wish I could make them happy. You can't make them happy. Happiness comes from within. So I'll be happy today if the Bucks win. Well, if my happiness is built on the Bucks, I'm in real trouble. Because they don't have an offense to speak of. And, if the Cadillac can't run today, well, they don't probably have much of a chance. You can't build, what are you going to build your happiness on? Sports? You know, people build their happiness on all sorts of things, and then guess what? It's all taken away from them. Well, 64, the last portion of verse 8 specifically declares that their eternal lot will be in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. Brimstone is sulfur. In 65, we have seen the Greek term meros, which means a part or a portion, previously used to describe the one that participates in the first resurrection. We saw that in Revelation 26 there, where it's pronounced a blessing on them. Blessed and holy is the one who has a part in the first resurrection. Well, of course, because the second death has no power over them. And as we saw there, this is a resurrection of people pre-church age and Daniel's 70th week. 66, the eternal portion of all unbelievers is the second death, which is defined as eternal separation from God in conscious torment in the lake of fire. No happiness, no joy, no friends, no love, no light, no nothing. Just misery, despair, and gloom for eternity. Regret, remorse, that's the way they're going to live. And apparently, again, they take their character with them. I assume that what we've described here in Revelation 21, their character, they are going to be cowardly in the lake of fire. They are going to be unbelieving in the lake of fire. They won't be able to murder, that's for sure. They're going to be abominated. God is going to express maximum discipline and judgment on them under his righteousness. Well, we move now to a new section, and this section actually comprises the rest of the chapter, dealing with the New Jerusalem. And one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues. We saw them in chapter 16, the final judgments that were poured out on the human race. And as Kai, one of the seven, actually the verb leads off in the sentence, came as erchomai, the verb to come, E-R-C-H-O-M-A-I. Numeral heis here, one from the seven angels. Preposition ek with the adjective heptai, which means seven, and then the word angelos, angels, A-N-G-E-L-O-S. The seven angels, the ones having, genitive plural here, of the definite article plus echo, the verb to have, E-C-H-O. The seven vials or bowls, as we pointed out, those they translated them bowls. Some translations use vials, but they were shallow saucer-shaped things, you know, on that order. So you have again the term seven hepta, and then the word phiale, P-H-I-A-L-E, the seven bowls, the seven last bowls. The seven bowls full. Then you've got a participle here of gemo, G-E-M-O, which means to be filled up or full of something, full of the seven plagues. And you've got the hepta again with the term plague, P-L-E-G-E. The seven, as I translated here, last is eschatos, the adjective. Genitive feminine plural. And again, this we get our word eschatology from this. Deals with last things. Last in sequence. We saw the seven seals opened. We saw the seven trumpet judgments. And then we see the seven bowl judgments. The last bowls, as it pointed out there, and I believe it was in Revelation 16, that in them here, the seven angels have, they bring these bowls out. And it says in there somewhere, and I can't find it right now, but basically says in them the wrath of God is finished. And so these occur very quickly, as we pointed out, down toward the end of Daniel's 70th week. You have the seven seals, which deal with sort of general events and conditions for the whole period. Then you had the seven trumpets, which really didn't start till just prior to the midpoint. My best guess is it's about the third year in the first month. The seven trumpets kick off. And they comprise events somewhat more specifically, fill in the details of events that are going to go on following the destruction of the U.S. They begin with that and then they move on. And then you've got the seven bowls, and they're down here toward the very end. They have to occur pretty quickly because man can't live long without water. And he can't live long without sunlight. And then, of course, the sun, at some sort of, we pointed out, a mini-nova or whatever happens to it, they can't live long in the intense heat they're facing as well. And they cursed God, of course, because of all of this. So you got the last plagues, those final seven. And he spoke with me, say. He came and spoke. Now you have the other verb, aorist indicative of laleo. Communicated or spoke, and this verb mean is different only in the sense that it tends to focus on the details, that there's added detail in the speaking as opposed to the simple verb to speak, lego. And he spoke with me, preposition meta with the genitive of ego, say, present active participle of lego, come. You got this aorist imperative of this word that actually sort of became it's a command, duro, D-E-U-R-O. Come here, and I will show you. There is no and here, but they just put a comma in the New American Standard. Dikeunomi is the verb, future active indicative, D-E-I-K-N-U-M-I. This word means to make something plain, to make it visible, to make something seen. I will show you, dative of Sue, the bride. Numphe, definite article, plus this word, N-U-M-P-H-E. The bride, the woman or wife, gune means woman in the Greek. Not a very flattering term, but that's the way, it's the Greek word. Definite article, gune. And the word means woman, but in context, depending upon where you have it, it can mean wife. When you talk about, and in this case, they've rightly translated it, as the wife of the Lamb, as again, Arnion, A-R-N-I-O-N. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. And as Kai, he carried me as Apophero, A-P-O-P-H-E-R-O. This word means to bear or carry. Apo means off from or away from. So to transport, you know, how he did it, we're not told. As we know, there's some indication in here that John is recording this as he goes. And we've seen this before where he was translated first into heaven. And here, and then he was taken off the other time, was back in chapter 17, where the angel said, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot, the great prostitute, who sits on many waters. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. Now here he carries him to a mountain. And he carried me away in the spirit. Preposition in, which tends to indicate, of course, that this is an out-of-body sort of experience for John. That he's not physically transported there. But he, his consciousness is there, as it was his soul is there. But his body is apparently not. In the spirit, too, is preposition epi, actually means upon, and so the idea is they're on the mountain, to a mountain, horos, H-O-R-O-S, great and high. And by great mountain, we would say to a large mountain. I mean, you can see a mountain, and you can see, you know, you can see a mountain that's 500 feet high. You can see mountains that are 5,000 feet high, and you can see mountains that are 11,000 feet high. And so there's a big difference in mountains. And so this one obviously is a big one. A large, and the other adjective you've got here is hupselos. H-U-P-S-E-L-O-S. That word means exactly that, lifted up, lofty, or high. So this is a big, high mountain. And he showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. And as Kai, you got the same verb again, dike knew me, he caused me to see, literally, or showed me, exhibited to me, dative of ego, the city, the holy. You got the word definite article plus polis, the city, and then you've got the adjective hagios. Again, holy focuses on that which is set apart, that which is unique in some way, that which is devoted to God. It gets into the idea that the whole city of Jerusalem has been separate to this point, and is separate. And so, again, holy focuses on that which is separated to God. The Jerusalem, the holy city Jerusalem. You got the indeclinable noun Jerusalem coming down as a present active participle. So apparently, John is standing there, as it were, watching the city descend. He's seeing the whole process. Coming down from the heaven. Preposition ek plus uranos, from God. And here's a good example of the classical usages, the distinction between ek that you can see. They're not always so well defined, but in this verse they're very well defined. Ek has the idea of out of, that the New Jerusalem had been in heaven and came out of it. And then from God has the idea of separation. Not so much that it was in God as that it's now God has sent it forth. So he showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven. Verse 11, having the glory of God. Her brilliance was like a very costly stone, a stone of crystal clear jasper. Having, again, is echo, which is can be used in a broad sense here. The idea here is it's radiating the glory of God. That this city is magnificent, that it is showing itself in terms of light reflection and refraction. To be able to explain it is going to be difficult. We have never seen anything like this. Probably the closest thing, if you saw a really big diamond, but this is way, way, way bigger than a diamond, the biggest diamond you've ever seen. And it's multifaceted. And as we're going to see, there's no darkness in the city. There's nothing to prohibit light from translating into it and radiating out of it and through it. All things in heaven are going to be light in phase three. So having the glory of God, doxa is the word for glory. And again, as we pointed out, there's two types of glory God has. His intrinsic glory, that which is intrinsic to him by virtue of who he is. God lives in light, which we don't understand, light which no man can approach. And out of his glory, the magnificence of his essence, God has this internal glory that is his and it never changes. And that's what he's talking about here. And then we talk about God's extrinsic glory. And this is the glory that people give to God as they live their life by his rules, as they glorify him through praise or worship or through the intake and application of doctrine. And so, in that regard, that glory is growing greater all the time and will continue to increase. That his internal glory never changes. But extrinsically, God will get glory forever and ever. And the bestowal of SG3 glorifies God. And so, while he himself never changes, the glory of God is on the increase, we might say. And what is the purpose of the entire angelic conflict? Why did God create anything? To share his glory. To let people see it. Moral creatures. See it and experience it and be a part of it. And for that, he's mightily maligned. Why did God create all this? I don't want any part of this. Oh, well, God's an idiot then. Well, God doesn't know what he's doing. Well, maybe there are actually very good, righteous reasons for everything he does. But and then there are. Just because we don't see them or they don't live up to what we think he ought to be doing or why he does it, that's really irrelevant, isn't it? I noticed he didn't bother checking with me about anything. And he hasn't checked with any of you that I know of about how he ought to do his plan or all that. Of course, none of us were there. This is, the pre-creation. God had no one to consult with. He didn't need to consult with anyone. He did everything perfectly. He's always done everything perfectly. And he voluntarily wants to reveal himself and share his glory. So, We're going to see that glory. The glory, having the glory of God, the glory that God has. Her brilliance was like a very costly stone. And so the glory of God is theos, genitive of theos, the glory which God possesses. Her brilliance, the word brilliance is phoster with a definite article, P-H-O-S-T-E-R. It's only used two times, nominative masculine singular. It means literally a star, something that gives light, and then it comes to mean the light given off by something. So radiance or brilliance is a good translation of it. Her brilliance, feminine, referring to the city. And then we see another comparison here, Hamoios. H-O-M-O-I-O-S. Again, this means of the same kind or nature, to resemble something. We've seen a lot of comparisons using host throughout this book. Such and such was like this. It was like this. It was like this. This word has the idea more of not just setting up a simile, but actual description of the sight. And it means to resemble something. Resembling a very costly stone. A stone, literally a valuable stone. You got lithos, the term for stone, with timios, the adjective, costly or valuable. And then you have a simile set up here, again, as or like, introduced here by the conjunction hos, as or like a stone, lithos, of Iaspis. I-A-S-P-I-S. It's only used four times and only in Revelation. It means jasper, but it's not the modern jasper which you may have seen, and if you haven't seen it, you can go on the internet and look up jasper, and they'll show you different, because it comes in different shades and all of that. More likely, this was what was our modern diamond. And then you have the word krustalizo here, the participle, perfect active part or present active participle, krustalizo. One time, this is the only place this verb's used here, clear or bright. And so it has the idea of transparent like a crystal, something you can see through. And so here we'll begin the description of this city, and we will get more into it and further information as we continue on here. One, John introduced us to the new heaven, the new earth, and the new Jerusalem in the first two verses of this chapter. Two, the section beginning with verse 3 and extending through verse 8 is parenthetical. And he now resumes with a fuller script description of what had been previously introduced. And this is pretty typical of Hebrew style, writing style. Although John's writing in Greek, he's still Jewish. And he very often in the scriptures, they'll give a summary statement and then elaborate on it and fill in the details. Two, the section beginning with verse 3 again is parenthetical. Three, when he described these three new things, he used the adjective kainos, new, to denote that which is distinct from that which is old, that which is new in quality, that which is fresh. For in terms of the new heaven and new earth, they are also new in point of time, since they did not come into existence until after the time of the great white throne judgment. We got sort of the summary statement, and he doesn't really describe other than parenthetically or just sort of in passing. If you look back in 2011, he talks about the dissolution of the present material universe, from whose presence earth and heaven fled away, and no place was found for them. And that's the event described, say, in 2 Peter 3 there, where it says the elements are going to melt with intense heat, that the very basic fundamental building blocks of all existence, of all matter in the space-time continuum, are going to be dissolved. So you go down the periodic table of elements. How much power and energy does it take to dissolve matter? Well, from mankind's perspective, we can't do it. That's one of the fundamental laws of science. We can neither create nor destroy matter. God can. And so apparently, again, the Great White Throne Judgment is transacted in a lack of a space-time continuum. And so we will deal with that. We've already dealt with it. But then we see the new heaven and new earth. He doesn't really say they were created. He just talks about them like they're there. I see them now. I saw a new heaven, verse 1, and a new earth. 5, from verse 2 in this chapter, it appears that the New Jerusalem existed prior to the new creation and is simply unveiled at that time. 6, the New Jerusalem is the city or dwelling place that Jesus promised his disciples that he would construct in his absence. That promise was given in John 14, 1 through 3. Stop letting your heart be troubled. And he knew the disciples were upset. He'd given them a bunch of bad news and told them he was going to die that night. And of course, they didn't buy that as much as they didn't buy the resurrection. But his speech was really upsetting them, and particularly with Peter. He just told him, he just dressed him down and said, "You're going to deny me three times." So he tells them, quit focusing on all this. This isn't the important stuff. The here and now is just here and now, and it's quickly passing away. Stop letting your heart be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? Again, I don't think the New American Standard does a good job. It's a question, actually. If this wasn't so, would I have told you about this? And referring to the fact that he had previously told them that they were going to have a home in heaven someday. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. So it's intriguing in that he talks about there's many dwelling places in his Father's house, but yet he's going to build to prepare these places. So it appears to be an expansion. I would assume that the dwelling places were, as it were, there already for the Jewish believers, that that provision had already been made. And understanding, again, as we saw, the whole eisegagics behind the wedding feast and the whole ceremony and all of that, that the bride, there was a period of betrothal where the bride and the groom were legally married, although they did not consummate the marriage, and they lived apart. Well, during that time, very often it could be as much as a year or more, the groom was off adding on generally to the father's house and making a place for his bride. In the patriarchal society, when the son got married, he'd go out and he'd get his bride, and then they just added on to the house, and the house got bigger, and they all lived in the same residence. I mean, it wasn't like they didn't have their own privacy and all that, but that was just the way it was done. And that's the idea behind all of this, that he's already got a dwelling place, as it were, but it's going to have to be enlarged. And the enlargement is for church-age believers, the apostles he addresses here first, of course. So 7, John is approached by one of the angels that had been responsible for the 7 final bowl judgments, just as he had been in chapter 17. 8, in neither case is the angel identified more closely. Nor is there anything that indicates whether this is the same angel or another one of the 7. And as we have pointed out repeatedly through here, that very much of these things that are said and done through the book we have seen are anonymous. You hear a voice, but it doesn't say who's speaking. You see an angel talking, but you're not told which angel it is. And so the whole point of all of this is it's the message that's important, not the messenger. And that it doesn't matter, in essence, as we saw these divine passives that we saw throughout the entire book, and it doesn't matter who says or does certain things. Ultimately, it's God that's responsible for it. And so here, clearly, the angel is acting in God's will and offering John a vision of this new place, the dwelling place for believers. 9, however, the fact that the angel was so intimately connected to the last judgment and now to the teaching of the truth serves as a good contrast between what may be expected of those that serve God. 11, there is a time and place for simply teaching the truth, and a time and place for acting in judgment when the plan of God calls for it. And so this same angel, who here is just simply John's instructor, is one of the same angels that poured out some intense wrath on the human race. And angels serve whatever function God has for them at that given time. And of their own volition, that's another thing that people hopefully don't lose sight of. These angels are doing this because they want to. They want to be a part of this. They delight in participating in God's plan and serving him. and recognize that it's the right thing to do. They're very intelligent creatures. So you got, again, there's time for various things. 11, this was clearly seen in the ministry of Paul as he worked with various local churches and as his tone and approach differed based on the volitional issues at hand. For instance, 2 Corinthians 10:1. And generally speaking, as we have pointed out, that the communicator is not to be a bully. He is not here to bully you. He's like a coach in some ways on a football team. You got to have a game plan. You got to have somebody going in that sees the big picture. You don't just get together. You know, you don't see the Buccaneers out on the field drawing plays in the dirt. You know, like you did in sandlot football. Okay, you go over here. Now I want you to go down this way, and then you draw little lines in the dirt, and that was going to be your play. Well, if we don't have any better than that, we're in trouble. I mean, we're facing a hugely superior enemy in Satan and his forces. So primarily, the major norm for the communicator is to be expressed as Paul does here. I, Paul, myself, urge you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. I, who am meek when face to face with you, but so bold towards you when absent. He's got a little tongue-in-cheek here. But the point is, generally speaking, you just instruct believers and you teach them the truth, and they're supposed to take it and run with it. And if they don't, well, then that escalates it to another level at some point. But you've got to, as it says in 2 Timothy there, as a part of the marching orders, you've got to proclaim the word. You've got to consistently get through the scriptures, in season and out of season, reproving, rebuking, exhorting, whatever you have to do, but with all patience and with all doctrine. You've got to stick with the text and get on with it. And the text, the Word of God, is what is the agent of phase two sanctification. So generally speaking, my tone is, okay, I'm just going to teach. Here's what you're going to get. You're going to get whatever we study, wherever we happen to be. And I'm not going to come in with the attitude that I've got to kick everybody's butt up between their shoulder blades. Now, there may be a time and a place for that. And if you don't respond under grace, well, yeah, then you're going to come under the other aspect of it. And then you see here, that compared, say, to 2 Corinthians 13:10. As Paul pointed out here, for this reason I am writing these things while absent, in order that when present I may not use severity, in accordance with the authority which the Lord gave me, for building up and not for tearing down. And so the whole purpose is, again, of the concept of teaching is to build believers up, to get them the doctrine so that they have a picture, one, of the kind of the big picture of the plan of God. One of the values of studying Revelation is we know where the plan of God is headed. We know things about the future. And so it helps us to avoid falling into various things that we can fall into, various forms of stupidity out there in the cosmos. The plausible idea that this country is somehow going to turn around. It's not. The idea that, you know, as I pointed out, well, everybody, as a matter of fact, there's an article in the paper about it today, about various forms of millennialism. And they say, you know, basically there are people, these kooks, more or less, that's how they sort of characterize the premillennialists, that believe Jesus is going to return bodily. Well, we'll see who's right. We'll find out. And the amillennialists, and, you know, it deals with that too. Well, 12, one should be aware that the tone of the letter to the Galatians differs dramatically from the tone of the letters to the church at Philippi or the church at Thessalonica. 13, when people are humble and willing to learn, the gentle approach should be the normal one the communicator employs. When they are arrogant and rebellious, a more stern tack must be taken. So 14, in that regard, the congregation as a whole has an influence on the manner in which the communicator deals with them, based on time and grade, consistency, teachability, level of application, etc. And so, again, normally speaking, so we've had to outgrow some of this stuff because as we all, you know, as the doctrinal movement, as it were, I don't even know that it's much of a movement, whatever it is, but certain things had to be coughed up. I mean, Theme would just get up there and just bombastically blast people from pillar to post. And that's inappropriate. Well, we've had to figure that out, move on. And that the tone isn't like that all the time. Somebody acts up in Bible class, does something he didn't like. I mean, I heard he threatened to come out. Some woman, I guess, had a nail file out once. You shouldn't be filing your nails in Bible class. But then for the pastor to say, I'm going to come out there and wrap that file around your ear, well, that's not really good either. Or, if you don't like what I'm saying, meet me in the parking lot afterwards. Well, no, that is not the proper approach. And I've heard that type of stuff. And so, you know, you don't have to challenge people all the time. It doesn't have to be, again, the relationship between pastor and congregation should be like the one between right man and right woman. It's mutually beneficial. And so if it's not mutually beneficial, well, then somebody's doing something wrong, frankly. So you got to deal with that. And so we, just like you see the angel here, one deal he's pouring out judgment, next minute he's just teaching. So this deals with, in some ways, how we have to deal with things. All right, well, our time's up, so we will stop there and continue on with this on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.